Hi there. Welcome to Writers Forum. Today, our guest in the studio is Sherry Lee Alexander, who is also the co-host of Writers Forum. So welcome into the other side of the microphone, Sherry Lee.
Well, thank you, Ted. It's very nice to be here.
I look at this as like crossing the streams in Ghostbusters. Hopefully there will be no total platonic reversal here. But here we are. I'm interviewing you, and you've been doing this a lot longer than I have, so it's maybe a little intimidating, but I'll see if I can bring my A game here. Anyway, so Sherry, you've written a book called Courtroom Carnival, Famous New Orleans Trials, and it's actually your third book. Give us a little background. People who've listened to you in the radio for a while now maybe don't know exactly what it is you do for your day job.
Well, my day job is I'm a journalist and a journalism professor, and I specialized most of my career in covering courts. So I've written a couple of books about covering courts. One is a handbook for journalists, and one's a reference book. And this book, this new one, is the work product itself. It's a trade book, and it's some of the coverage of some very colorful litigants in New Orleans courtrooms.
Your first two books are more for academic purposes. Why did you decide, or how did you decide to do one that's more for the public or mass consumption?
Well, I was covering Governor Edwards' riverboat casino trials, and I was writing about the coverage of the case itself. I wrote for a judge's journal and a law journal and a journalism journal, and people were just so intrigued. And everybody said, well, where can we read about it? And that gave me the idea that maybe some of the litigants were so interesting, such colorful personalities that – and particularly Governor Edwards, everybody wanted to know more about Governor Edwards. So I just decided, why not?
Mm-hmm. Governor Edwards takes up a good part of the book towards the very end, actually. He has the he's sort of the subject of the final two chapters. But you have a number of other very, very notable and quirky personalities that dominate this book.
Only in New Orleans.
Yeah, only in New Orleans type people. And so to kind of go through it, not a list of everybody per se, but I've only lived in New Orleans for 11 years, so a lot of these people I wasn't really familiar with. I know about Al Copeland, of course, and I knew about Governor Edwards. But there's some other people here like Robert Angelico that I had no idea about, or Ron Hunter. And these are really, really fascinating stories. Well, let's start with you wrote the book. You decided to write each chapter on a different personality. You also had some help. You had some co-authors for this.
I'm so grateful. I was about halfway through the book, and I had some health events, and I thought, oh, boy, I need some help finishing this. And five wonderful friends pitched in. One, Lynn Koppel, also works here at WRBH. She does a current events program, the public service program on Sunday mornings. Charles Zewi was a CNN reporter for 15 years, and he's now a vice president up in the LSU system. Erin Brimmer was a grad student. She's still in grad school. Glenn Watts is the assistant attorney general of the state of Mississippi. And Jennifer John Block was a TV reporter for WWL, and now she makes documentaries. And I owe them a debt of gratitude I can never repay. They jumped in and helped me finish five of the chapters.
A number of the people in the book have of the subjects have passed on, but a number have not. Did you consult with any of the people who are still alive before the book came to press?
Oh, yes. We originally, the subtitle was True Live Tales of New Orleans Courtrooms. These are more or less recent cases in the past 10 years. And everybody was alive when we started writing it, and we interviewed everybody. In fact, I think Harry Lee, Jennifer, interviewed him just a couple of months before he passed. So they all knew, all the subjects knew that we were writing this.
Did you have their blessing? Nobody was mad at you? Or maybe I should withdraw that question.
So far, so good. But, of course, the book just came out 2 days ago. So.
That's true. There's a funny quote in there at some point where – was it you who said it in the book? I'm not sure, but somebody says – nobody ever ended up in the trunk of a car for criticizing Governor Edwards or something
right.
like that.
I was on a radio program, the Andre Trevine Show, during his trial, and there was you weren't here, but there was intense interest in that case. And people were talking about all the secrecy that was surrounding it. The records were sealed and the jurors were sealed and so on. And so I said that I felt that it was a little extreme, because it wasn't like a mafia trial where you might end up in the trunk of a car if you voted to convict him. And he had heard about it. And so, of course, being Governor Edwards, he said, "You're wrong, Cher. I'm very violent, but only in bed and only if she consents." You know, he's just unstoppable.
So you start with a very larger-than-life character, Al Copeland, who, of course, as you mentioned, was alive when you started working on the book. And that chapter actually starts very interesting, because it starts with him going to get treatment in Europe and sort of having a spiritual encounter.
He's a fascinating person, and something that some people need to understand. These chapters aren't all necessarily criminal trials. They're all not necessarily – in fact, there's no murder trials at all, although Ron Hunter was suspected by many people of having a hand in his wife's suicide. But the only case that came out of that particular issue was a libel case. But Al Copeland's issues, you know, he started Popeye's Chicken. He's very flamboyant. Everybody that was here remembers he had the Christmas tree lights. Every Christmas people would go and see out to his home in Metairie. And a very colorful person. Well, in his private life, he was very colorful, and he wasn't very private. He was married and divorced four times, and on one of his divorces hit the news because the judge was accused of taking some sort of favors from Al Copeland, mainly selling shrimp to his restaurant, and the judge ended up in prison, and Copeland's own lawyer ended up in prison and was disbarred over it, so that was the courtroom connection. But he was just a fascinating, colorful person. And of course, with Popeyes, he had dozens, if not maybe 100 lawsuits involving the secret recipe for the spices and things like that. But any businessman has a lot of, legal activity. But I don't know, he seemed to inspire a lot of lawsuits.
My impression from the book is that although we're dealing with some people who have some very shady dealings, and not all of them do, some of them are not like that at all, but I gather you treat everybody very fairly, I think.
Well, thank you. I try to keep my journalism hat on and not let my own personal feelings enter into it, and I feel that you owe that when you're a journalist. Our codes of ethics call for that, but yeah. Of course you have in your own heart certain feelings.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that too, because I kept asking myself while reading the book. I said, does Sherry Lee like this person or not? And I would read the chapter and I'd say at one point, aha, yes, she does. And then I get to another point and go, oh, no, she doesn't. And I go, well, at the end, I can't tell.
Well, it's a little different from many writers today who are personalities. And I've said this before. I'm not a personality. I could never write fiction. I once tried to write a fictional story, and it was a true story, and it involved a murder, actually, and I just changed the names, and I sent it in, and they said, stick to the journalism.
Don't give up your
this
day
is, doesn't
job.
Sound at all realistic. And I said, but it really happened, but no, I'm just a journalist. I can just present the facts. And this book is not a lot of original interviews and so on. What we did is we took a different approach. We started with the court records, which I think people overlook this. And I was intrigued, and I said, I bet we could write their story going through the court records. And now with the internet, of course, everything is online, and you can search their civil suits, their marriages, their divorces. And then you go down to the courthouse, and one of the subjects who was divorced, his I think it was a 3 feet high pile just from his divorce, one divorce case. So you could just mine that. And if you were a fiction writer, you could create a whole person's life out of his court records.
Some of these subjects are a little more prolific in the courtroom than others. For instance, I imagine there's a lot of work that had to be done to follow up on some of these court cases. I mean, Copeland, of course, is one of them. Antoine Sachs, who's the second chapter. Am I pronouncing his name correctly?
Yes.
Is Antoine Sachs?
Okay. He was a deputy police chief and very colorful person. And I do have this disclaimer that I was in a political Institute of Politics class with Antoine, and he did come and speak to my students before he was convicted in federal court on a tax fraud case, and he went away for a couple of years. For a couple of years there, the secretaries in my office were very intrigued with all my pen pals. At least three of the subjects that were in prison, I was corresponding with them, interviewing them, and so on. And Antoine was one of them. And he paid me, I thought, quite a compliment. He said, you know, I'm not that I'm going to like what you say necessarily, but I think you'll be fair, and that's about what a person can ask for. So I felt good about that.
There's two Law and Order guys you write about, the two Harrys, Harry Lee, who was a sheriff of Jefferson Parish, and Harry Connick Sr., not Jr., Harry Connick Sr., who the singing DA for Orleans Parish. It's probably not a surprise you chose to write about Harry Lee and Harry Connick. And actually, your co-authors here were helped you with this one. They come across as fairly likable fellows, but again, you don't pull your punches with these characters either.
Well, Harry Lee, Jennifer John ended up doing the chapter on Harry Lee. He was very outspoken. First of all, it was unusual, an Asian American. He was Chinese. He called himself Chinese American. His parents were immigrants. He was born over the typical Chinese laundry. And there aren't a lot of Chinese American sheriffs. He did go to law school, and at one point he was even considering or maybe made a short announcement that he would run for governor. But he was quite at home in Jefferson Parish, and the people reelected him time and time again. Some of the lawsuits involved his attitude toward racial profiling. And then there were some funny lawsuits where he was accused of hunting on a baited field in Mississippi. But most of the lawsuits that we found were civil suits where Harry Lee sued the Times-Picayune. They wrote something about him and he didn't like it. And he was a lawyer. He knew he wasn't going to win. But boy, golly, he exercised his right to sue the Times-Picayune at least, I think, a dozen times.
Yeah, I was wondering how many times it was. It seems like
he
a
never
lot.
Won. He never won, but he, you know, he walked his talk and he was what he was.
There are two people in the book, I think, that sort of I found to be maybe the most interesting. Again, I hadn't heard about them before. Michael O'Keefe and Richard Angelico. These are chapters you wrote, of course, as well. And those are the ones I sort of looked at as being, these are really, really interesting. At one point during the chapter on Richard Angelico, he goes to court to fight a $100 fine, and it was a TV station that he worked for, paid $60,000 in court costs in order to fight this $100 fine.
I'm not sure a lot of people who watched him, he was on the air here for 40 years, which is also very unusual for somebody of his accomplishments to stay in town. He only worked at two stations here, most notably at WDSU. He just retired. He was an investigative reporter in every sense of the word, and he was one of the first people to expose the fact that the internet, which at the time, we're talking 15, 20 years ago, was a brand new thing, was a hunting ground for pedophiles. And he really set the stage for a lot of other investigative reporters all around the country to do these investigative stories. He had an investigator that he worked with who pretended he was a 13-year-old boy, and they kind of set out to see if pedophiles would come after them. And there was one marvelous case I remember when it was on the air where he set up an assignation with a guy named Bama Joe, who was actually a Mississippi radio personality. And the guy shows up and is helping this supposed 13-year-old boy, Timmy, who was really the son of the investigator, and he was 18. And Richie comes out. He's in a car nearby, and the whole thing is on video. And he says, you know, it's against the law to use the internet to set up a an arrangement like this with a kid. And Bama Joe says, oh, no, I never did that. And Richie takes, you know, we used to have that big printout computer paper. And he says, well, no, I mean, you were corresponding with Timmy, but guess what? I was Timmy. And so Bama Joe looks at him. He says, no, that's not me. You know, I didn't do that. And he jumps in his car. And Richie says, well, aren't you Bama Joe? And he says, oh, no, I'm not even him. And as he drives away, the camera zooms in on his vanity plate, Bama Joe, you know. So Richie sent a lot of people to prison. He and I, again, he would come and speak to my students sometime. And he and I disagreed a couple of times. I thought he was a little, if such a thing could be, overzealous. But he said it. He said, look, wrong is wrong. And even if it's a minor crime, you shouldn't commit these crimes. His old news director, Joe Duke, said to me once, you know, Richie was an Eagle Scout, and he's still an Eagle Scout. He's 60 years old, but he's still an Eagle Scout.
There's a great quote, and I think he might have said this to you, but tell me if I'm wrong. It's on page 148 of the book. It's he says, I always wonder why people, especially public officials with the capacity to do so much good, choose to do evil.
He's just 100% like that. He's the most decent reporter that I've ever met out there, and he never got jaded. He never took shortcuts. I really, really admire him.
Speaking of someone maybe a little less admirable, Ron Hunter.
Ron Hunter was also a newsman, and the people that remember him, they remember a different type of reporter. He was, I was actually on the air against him. I was a reporter at a competing station in Miami, and at the time, it was a long time ago, and I remember he got the sexiest guy in Miami. He got the award, you know, voted. He was very, very attractive. And he did more sensationalistic kind of stories. And some of the anecdotes were one that he did a story about rescuing a dog or something, and the cameraman didn't get it. So he threw the dog back into the river so that he could be rescued on the air. But what most people remember is the big story, very eerily similar to O.J. Simpson. His wife died, and it was in June. She had filed for divorce. There are many, many similarities. They had a son. They had a daughter. And in Ron Hunter's case, she wasn't murdered. She shot herself, and he was lying on the bed next to her. And many people in New Orleans felt that he might have had something to do with it. He was cleared completely by the medical examiner, but some people commented on the air that they felt that all the facts hadn't come out, and the biggest suit he ended up with was a big libel suit against the station and against several other people for saying he got away with murdering his wife.
Mm-hmm. Even his own daughter, I think, sort of comes to his defense, doesn't she?
His daughter is, she was very young. And, of course, when her mother died, she remembers it very well. I think she was maybe 11 or 12, and her kid brother was really young, 3 or 4. And she's gone on with her life. She's gone through college and so on. But she said that she ended up estranged from her father toward the end. He just died a couple of years ago and had moved out to Nevada.
There's a fellow by the name of, and correct me if I say his name wrong, it's Sherman Copeland?
Yeah, well, he is a person that has a very colorful background in this city, in this state. He's accomplished many, many things. And since I didn't write that chapter, maybe we'll
move on. We'll move on to the Edwin Edwards, two chapters on Edwin Edwards that close out the book. You started covering Edwin Edwards during one of the court cases. Which court case?
I started covering him in the 2000 trial, okay, which was the big one. He had been investigated 22 times, and only twice had he gone to trial in 1985 in New Orleans, and he mocked the prosecutor. He went to Molly's at the market and made limericks about John Volz, and he rode a mule-drawn carriage to the courthouse. He said justice was so slow. So for whatever reason, and some people thought it was what we call forum shopping, trying to get a jury that wouldn't be so sympathetic to Edwin Edwards, even though the prosecutor was from New Orleans, they moved the trial to Baton Rouge because they wanted to get a conviction after all that time. And they did. Mm-hmm. They did get a conviction. And he served 10 years in prison. He just got out, as we're taping this, a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. People locally know this. He married a young woman that started corresponding with him in prison. And I went to a roast, and just to show you that Edwin Edwards is still as witty as ever, his brother tells this story that he said, you know, Edwin, you're marrying a much younger woman. She's 32, and he just turned 84. And his brother said, Edwin, you know, this can be very dangerous. You have to be very, very careful marrying a younger woman. And Edwin just looked at him and said, well, if she dies, she dies. So prison didn't stop his sense of humor.
You'll have time to work on some more quips, I guess. Would you like to read a little bit of
Sure.
Is it chapter? What number chapter is it? It's
the last chapter. Yeah. Because what I did, I ended up making it two chapters because really you could have a whole little book on the wit and wisdom of Edwin Edwards. But if it's all right, I'll read the introduction to the chapter and then maybe talk about that. The chapter is Edwin Edwards, Fast Eddie Plays the Game the Louisiana Way. On January 10th, 2000, the 34-story state capitol in Baton Rouge, which both literally and figuratively casts a great shadow, the legacy of legendary Depression-era populist governor and assassinated presidential candidate Huey Long, was abuzz with a full day and evening of events in honor of the second inauguration of Murphy Mike Foster, who had recently been reelected governor of Louisiana. However, the focus of press scrutiny was across town at the more modest three-story federal courthouse at the opening of the trial of four-time former governor Edwin Edwards, the chief of seven defendants in a case which originally involved 34 racketeering charges in connection with the awarding of riverboat casino licenses. With Edwards facing a possible sentence of millions of dollars in fine and hundreds of years in prison. U.S. versus EWE was the first in a trifecta of then-pending cases involving Edwards. With potential evidence including reportedly the most expensive wiretaps in FBI history, $1.5 million, 26,000 conversations recorded. The trial took more than 4 months, resulted in 30,000 pages of transcripts, and included filing of nearly 1,500 documents. Truly the new millennium's first trial of the century. Although this was to be his first conviction, this was not the first time Edwin Edwards, also called Fast Eddie and the Silver Fox, faced criminal charges. In fact, the 72-year-old populist prince had been the subject of about the same number of government investigations, more than 20, including charges involving insurance fraud, campaign finances, and various business deals, as successful election campaigns, starting with the Crowley City Council, state senator, and U.S. Congress, before the unprecedented 4 terms as governor, his final term after defeating David Duke. Throughout his career, the smooth-talking, poker-playing, crap-shooting Fast Eddie was widely known by admirers and detractors alike as the acknowledged master of what, when describing Louisiana politics, has come to be called playing the game the Louisiana way. And he had so many fascinating quotes. We have a whole chapter with 100 quotes of his, and I divided them into categories. Edwin Edwards on women, which, of course, is just priceless. Edwin Edwards on gambling. Edwin Edwards on his different trials. Edwin Edwards on his legacy, and so on. And I think one quote, which he wrote in an epilogue to his authorized biography by Leo Honeycutt, which we interviewed Leo here on WRVH when his book came out. But Edwards added this epilogue in 2009. He said, "Am I guilty? Absolutely, I'm guilty of arrogance. To compound my mistake, I enjoyed humor and the gift of a quick wit that both helped and hurt me. I was also guilty of trusting the wrong sources, letting some shady folks get close to me whom I thought I could help legitimately, and some were less than honest. Finally, I admit I was guilty of not taking more personal responsibility for my questioned actions at the time. To the extent that I tainted my beloved state's image, I'm deeply sorry. But in all truthfulness and sincerity, I had help." You pointed out that he also took a more serious tact when I asked him how he would like to be remembered. He said, "Well, I said jokingly one time, they ought to put on my tombstone, 'He left too early.'" Edwards smiled. Asked to consider the question seriously, Edwards concluded, "I guess in a way the thing I'm really proudest of and I think goes largely unheralded is I came from a long line from very poor family and made my way, and when I got to a position of power, I didn't forget where I came from. And my whole political career and life has been guided by helping people who need it. I've paid a price for it, because those that don't need it are the opinion makers and publishers and the powerful, and they have never been my source of support or my friends. I was never comfortable with the rich and powerful. I always had an empathy for others, and that caused the rich and the powerful to have some concerns about me because I was, quote, not one of them. So I never was. I didn't come into the world as one of them, and I never forgot where I came from."
I think it's a very interesting quote from him, and certainly one that quip free, and it seems to come from the heart. Hopefully it did.
I think so. I felt like it did.
Yeah. Are there anyone you left? Is there anyone you left out that you really wanted to include in this book?
Well, many people have come up to me and made suggestions, and they said, "Well, what about so-and-so, Congressman so-and-so, or what about these murder trials?" And there's just no shortage of characters here in New Orleans. You could write another whole book, and people said, "Well, you're going to write a sequel." But I don't know. We just got this one out, so we'll see.
See how this one does first.
Right.
Yeah, there is a lot of – yeah, you can do a courtroom carnival too probably with no problem. And, of course, I think you'd also suggested at one point, or someone had suggested, that the final chapter of quotes from Edwin Edwards could actually be released as his own book.
It is. The wit and wisdom of Edwin Edwards could easily be its own book, because some of them people have heard before, but some of them are very poignant and touching. When you see them all in one place, it captures the spirit of them.
Yeah. When I was in Detroit, we had a mayor named Coleman Young, who served four terms as mayor of the city of Detroit. And while I was up there, a book was released of his sayings. It was a little red book, tiny red book. It was called – it was based on like Chairman Mao's little red book. And it was his wit and wisdom of Coleman Young. And none of it you could repeat in the radio. Absolutely none of it. He was so profane and filthy. It was a funny book, and I still have my copy at home. Yeah, Edwards at least keeps it mainly clean, I suppose.
Well, in public, he's, you know, he's always gentlemanly-like. And I would like to say all the subjects were very gracious to us. And considering the fact that several of them were in prison, they were all under all kinds of pressure, I really am very grateful to all the subjects for being so pleasant and gracious.
Well, it's a terrific book. It's a lot of fun. I learned a lot. So hope it does great.
Thank you.
Well, our time is up, Sherry Lee. We got through it. The world didn't end. I interviewed my co-host.
Well, thank you, Ted. I'm glad I didn't have to interview myself.
That was very interesting, too, of course, but I'm glad I got to do it.
Thank you.
So anyway, this has been Writers Forum. I'm Ted O'Brien. You've been listening to Sherry Lee Alexander. Thanks for listening.